tell you what. Anyway, it's but the problem is obviously like where are we going with it? Like you hate to use the line that the trite line that it's unprecedented, but it damn well is. So you know what? It's human nature to want answers, and it's human nature to want more higher degrees of certainty and stuff like that. But it just can't be provided, really. Like especially since so many nations went and defunded their pandemic response agencies. Australia did it. United States did it. I don't know if the UK did, but you know, our country's as guilty as any.
Yeah, I think. I mean, in the UK, we had a lot of people that were just not taking it seriously. So when I came back from. Because I was stuck in Spain when the European style lockdown
started. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And when I came back to the UK, I managed to get one of the last flights home to London from Calpe, and from Benidorm, I think is the airport. Yeah. I can't remember what it is. Whatever it is. I got one of the last flights back. So the airline I was flying with, I don't care. I'm recording now. I'm going to cut them. It was EasyJet. It was shit. Right. And basically, they cancelled all of their flights, and they put on what are called repatriation flights. But these repatriation, so my flight back was cancelled, and then these repatriation flights, they basically sent an email to everyone saying, "We're not exactly sure when these flights are going to go, but they will be first come, first served. So you got to be quick." That was long and short of the email. So when I saw that, I just went straight onto the EasyJet website and I was like, okay, how much is it going to cost me to get any flight home before they start these repatriation flights? Luckily, I managed to get a flight back with EasyJet. It cost me quite a lot of money to do it. But it meant I didn't have to deal with all the madness of the whole repatriation thing. Anyway, going off on a slight tangent, the bit that really kind of shocked me was that when the plane landed, loads of the people on the plane were clapping and cheering. And I was why the fuck are you clapping and cheering? First of all, the chances are very high that you're the person that's about to bring it into the UK or another person that's about to bring it into the UK. Second point, we're fucking going to get it imminently. So why the hell celebrate? They were oh, we're safe now and all this sort of shit. I was just oh my God. I know there's a lot of stuff going on about stereotyping and all that sort of stuff in the press right now. People that generally go on holiday to Benidorm, there's a TV series in the UK called Benidorm. And that TV series sums up very, very well the stereotype of people that quite often holiday in Benidorm.
We're definitely not punching down here. I know it's pretty easy to assume the class of the demographic of people who are going to Benidorm, and they probably look a lot like us. white middle-aged.
White middle-aged.
We can do it. Yeah, hit them. we're punching up here. It's okay.
Well, I mean, it's actually the Benidorm thing is actually an older demographic.
Oh, is it really? Right. Fantastic.
Yeah. So it's 50 plus probably.
Sure.
But anyway, I am recording. I have on the other side of, literally on the other side of the world, probably the man with the best surname in existence.
Oh, I don't know about that. I mean, Steele von Hoff, one of my cycling mates. It's very hard to top his surname, von Hoff.
Yeah, okay.
Don't hassle the Hoff. mine's great. Mine's great if you've got triple word score on Scrabble, and they let you use nouns. I mean, all the vowels. There's a Q.
You just need a Z, don't you? Really?
That's right. That's right. And it'll be game over.
Yeah, I mean, so I've got Nick Scolari, who is Mr. Velo Kick, I'm going to say. But not only are you Mr. Velo Kicks, you're an absolute beast of a bike rider. Time trialing. Race with Black Sheep Bound, do e-bike racing, very accomplished all round. has a very nice. I mean, you repainted your 3D bike, didn't you?
Well, I actually bought it repainted. I didn't go through the process of doing it. The guy who I bought it from went through the whole rigmarole of getting it repainted, and then decided he didn't like TTs. And I'd eyed it off at a couple of TT races he'd done previously. And then when he put it up for sale, I was just like, I'm going to have some of that.
Yeah, it's really nice. Is it a P5?
No, P3 with a P5 front end. Yeah.
With a P5 front end. Ah, that's what gives it away. I mean, to be honest with you, like, the difference between the P3 and P5 of that generation is not a lot different.
Oh, yeah, it's so minimal. It's so minimal. And, geez, it's a terrific bike.
Yeah.
Got a lot of love for it.
It looks fucking smart. Is it chrome? Yeah. The decals and stuff?
Yep.
Yeah, I'm all about that. I'm loving that bike. And then, yep. So we met on the last day of Franny Pants and I riding on some stupid bike ride across some big country where everything wants to kill you, namely Australia.
Just on that, you've got to see. It was on the news today. A guy got pulled over by the police. He was speeding. He was doing 123 in a 100 zone, and they said to him, "Mate, why are you speeding?" And he's got his chest camera on, so it's all on the news websites. And the guy's just like, he's speeding his way to hospital. He thought he'd been bitten by a brown snake that had crawled into his cab while he was on the highway doing 100, wrapped itself around his leg and just started striking randomly at the seat, at his leg, all that kind of stuff. So he pulled out a knife, because every Aussie obviously carries a knife, kills this brown snake at 100 k's an hour, throws it into the back of his ute, and then proceeds to speed his way to hospital until the police pull him over on the way. Only in Australia would you get that story.
I mean, is it? Yeah, I don't really know how to respond to that.
Yeah, it popped up. It popped on my Twitter timeline 90 minutes ago. I was just typically Australian. Yeah. So you're right. Like, there is, you can't even go to work without something trying to kill you.
Yeah, but it's still an amazing country. We met on our last day riding into Melbourne, and you managed to drop Mark Ferguson, which was hilarious, multiple times. Which for me was probably one of the funniest things of that whole like ride in was how physically fucked Francis and I were. Like, we were knackered. And yet, fucking Maven, like, literally had reached, so he rode from his to Shane Miller's to meet us at Shane's. He was like, oh, I'll be there at 4 o'clock. And we were like, okay, that's cool. So Franny and I got there at like 2-ish, I think. And Shane, Shane and Von put on like this amazing dinner for us. Like, it's incredible. They are like two of the nicest people in the world. Put this incredible dinner.
Truly, truly fantastic.
Good humans, aren't they? And Shane was like, look, I've even bought you some gummy snakes. I've even bought some Sour Patch Kids. I've got like, everything's vegan, so you don't need to worry. Like, it was just like, it was so kind of him. And yeah, anyway, Maven was like, I'll be there at 4. And we were like, okay, cool. Anyway, I think he turned up at 9 o'clock at night, and he was fucked, like not drunk, like physically fucked. And basically he'd forgot. He was like, oh, the ride's not that far, like the distance from where he was to Ballarat I don't think is that far. And so he was just like, oh, I'll just ride it, but he didn't think that it was all uphill.
That's right.
So he got like halfway up one of the hills, pulled into some like roadhouse, got a plate of chips, ate some chips, carried on riding. Anyway, he didn't turn up till 9 o'clock. He turned up and he was like, I am fucked. And then, the next morning, he like hung around for a bit. We had, had a catch up, had some beer and all that sort of stuff. And then the next morning, he met us at this cafe for breakfast with Shane. So Shane Ferguson, Franny and me. And then he was like, all right, we'll all ride into Melbourne together, and he'd organized for you, and he'd said that you should come meet us as well. But when we bumped into you, which was on some particular, pretty busy road.
Terrible road as well, like no shoulder.
Yeah, but I mean, on the scale of the kind of roads that we had cycled across, it was actually pretty tame. And so but he was fucked. He was absolutely fucked. He was lagging off the back of the four of us, wasn't he?
He was. But the funniest part was how his performance and just his basic energy levels improved and increased once we hit the pub and just started pumping beers in.
Yeah. Yeah. The moment the beers came in, he was like, I'm back in the game. I'm back in the game.
He was. Yes, right. It was the best second wind ever.
Yeah, and it is me who could have like two beers and I'm hammered. Had to go and get remember I had to go get the keys to the hotel room.
That's right. Yep.
I mean, conveniently the hotel was pretty close, but I remember rolling down to the hotel thinking, oh man, this is not the wisest decision I've had to do this now.
And the funniest thing is, like, of all of us, he still had the furthest to get home at the end of the night. And given his physical state and how much his blood alcohol levels, it's a miracle he made it home. Like, he said he rode all the way. I was just like, Maeve, get an Uber. Like, don't ride home. He rode home.
See that guy. I mean,
he is mad.
He is a character of his own right, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. We love him.
Anyway. So, I mean, that was, you know, it's an awesome way to meet you. And, you know, as someone that followed Velo Kick for a long time, I was like some weird kind of fanboy feeling in some way. But, yeah, like Velo Kicks is like, it's pretty nuts. Like, I mean, you had the ridiculously unfortunate event the other week. We were going to record this podcast a while ago, and then the account got hacked, didn't it?
Oh, man, yeah. What a 48 hours that was. I mean, just because 2020 just hasn't been hard enough for everything. And then, to get hacked was really just the icing on top.
But you've got it all back. It's back up and running. Obviously, you've lost all of the amazing
posts. Yeah, the posts are gone.
But yeah. You've still got all the things that you were tagged in are still available now, which is good.
Yeah, look, the hackers, they weren't that smart. They were smart enough to get into the account, but they removed all the posts. But, yeah, they didn't remove the tags. They didn't remove the archives. And from what I can gather, the intention is when they pull this is to then sell the account because there's there's a certain World Tour pro who got in touch and reached out to try and do what he could, offer what services he could to help us recover our content. But he had a friend that it had also happened to as well. So he shared what he knew and the processes that they were going through. But he said, yeah, it's happened to a mate of his. And then large Instagram accounts, I think it was Best Bike Kit or something like that. He reached out, one of their influencers has had it happen. So there was definitely a run on by these hackers to get into these large accounts because then they clear all the data off or clear all the posts off and then they sell them.
It's fucking ridiculous, isn't it?
It's
quite worrying that people could do that, but it's good that you got it all back, thankfully.
Yeah, that's right. Look, the posts we can repost things, but the audience is what matters the most to us because we've authentically built it. I mean, it's been this December; it'll be 5 years since I started the account. So, all authentically built. A lot of engagement. A lot of people that we follow and careers and just characters that we value. So, if we had lost that, that would have been truly gutting. Yeah.
So did you start the account on the basis of an obsession with feet? I mean, I know you're let's talk about what your background is. You are a footman anyway.
I am a footman. And I'd be a rich man if I got a dollar for every time people thought that I had some sort of obsession with feet. But look, it's not actually an unrealistic question in certain ways to ask. I was sitting down with a friend the other day and came to the realization that there's probably not an hour or so in the day that goes by that I'm not, whether it's podiatrically or whether it's through Velo Kicks, there's barely an hour that goes by that I'm not doing something that involves a foot or feet. So yeah, you could mount a pretty fair argument that I am obsessed with feet, but just not in a Quentin Tarantino kind of way.
You're obsessed with feet as it is your job, basically.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. And a passion, really. Like, I like shoes. I like cycling shoes. Look, it's going to be cliche at the moment to say I liked Air Jordans and all that kind of stuff with The Last Dance. But, always had an interest in shoes when I was younger, which is, no small part why I became a podiatrist.
Yeah.
And then started cycling. And it wasn't that I was really obsessed with cycling shoes. I was obsessed with trying to get comfortable in them. I've got really big feet. And, I mean, the other line that I get all the time when people contact me, which I encourage them to do before they get a pair of our shoes, if they've got any doubts about their sizing, I'm just like, look, drop me an email. I'll help you with the sizing. Let's talk about it. And most people are just like, look, I've got the worst feet ever. Even podiatrically, they'd say that. The good news is that most people don't have the worst feet ever. But when I was at university, they would quite commonly actually use me as the prac subject, because even the podiatry lecturers were just like, Nick, it's a good thing you're becoming a podiatrist because your feet are fucked.
What's the problem you have with your feet then?
Look, they're really, for their length, they're really quite wide. I've got a tailor's bunion on either side, so that's a bunion on the outside of your foot rather than on the inside of the foot, where most people see a bunion deformity. And then additionally, I get chilblains. I've got Raynaud's phenomenon, so which means my feet, even on a blisteringly hot Australian summer's day, my feet can be as cold as ice. So in the winter, I get chilblains. Even with shoe covers, I've got to like really, really rug my feet up to stop breaking out in chilblains. So if ever there was a foot built to test the limits of a cycling shoe, I've got it.
Yeah, I mean that's pretty nuts. Like I've always thought that I have. I think we talked about it a bit in Australia. I've always thought I've had like fucked up feet because I've always struggled with cycling shoes, always.
Mm.
And I feel like I've tried everything under the sun, and I've got to. I wear Shimano S-Fire shoes now, which I think they're the best that I've found so far.
Yep.
And previously, I tried like Physique, Bond, Giro. I can't even think what else I would have tried, but like I didn't. I obviously it's so personal, so I'm not like slating any brand here or anything. But like Physique for me were terrible. Like I couldn't get the cleats far enough back. Bond for me were terrible because they were too stiff. Giro were kind of all right, and then the Shimano ones are like the best that I've found so far. I actually think they're really underrated as shoes.
They make a really good shoe. Yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot of people kind of go, I don't know what it is, but I think people go, oh, they're not a shoe company. They're kind of an everything company, but their shoes are very, very good. I mean, the kind of testament to it, I think, is when you see, if you see the level of like pro riders wearing them. I mean, take it or leave it, sponsored. You know, some have to wear certain brands for sponsorship, but actually there is a lot of riders who seem to wear Shimano S-Fire shoes. But anyway.
Just on that, as far as contact points go, and this is something that's still, I'm sure I'm not the only person perplexed by this when it comes to pro cycling, it's still incredible that teams would sign contact point sponsorships with any given brand. It blows my mind. Like that really should be saddles, shoes, they should totally be up to the rider's choices. As a manufacturer, I can understand why you would want that. As a retailer, I can understand why you'd want that. But as a podiatrist, the other podiatrist side of me goes like, no, like let them choose.
Mate, I'm 100% with you because it just like, I mean, same thing with saddles. Like I've struggled with saddles for a long time. I'm definitely one of those people that feels like the micro changes on a bike. And I for a long time I got on with the specialized roaming, which I think was a saddle that a lot of people get on with. But then I tried the pro stealth, and I was just like, why the fuck have I been sitting on a roaming? But like, I thought the roaming was the comfortable one, and then I jumped on the. But the thing is, when I first tried the stealth, I wasn't convinced. Like, it felt intrusive to me because it was wider than I instinctively knew. But then it's the saddle I rode across Australia on, like, and I had no issues, like no undercarriage issues at all. Which, like, in contrast, Francis was riding the stock saddle that came with his Velia, and he wasn't comfortable on it. So it's interesting. Like, I completely agree with you. Like, as a human being, I would hate to be in a team where you're prescribed a saddle sponsor and a shoe sponsor, because everyone is different and they're the most important bits. But you know, you think you're riding a grand tour, which is what, 3,000 plus kilometers over 20 odd days, and you're not comfortable on a bike. It's gonna make you lose any kind of passion or love for the sport, surely. I mean, it would for me anyway.
Like, oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, those things are hard enough to get through when you're fully fit and everything. Going the
right way. Yeah, exactly. So, you've gone quiet. Are you back?
Hold on.
You're back.
I'm back.
Yeah, it's that Australian Wi-Fi, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is. Oh, my God. What a mess.
So the Velokix account, so that... Because I know Velokix now make shoes. Did it?
Yes.
Was that something that came subsequently from starting the account?
Well, sorry, what was that?
So you back?
Yep. Yeah, I'm back.
Okay, yeah. So with Velokix, the account's like 80,000 followers now, which is mental.
But yes.
Was it all about like showcasing awesome shoes, and then you sort of thought, I got the expertise and the knowledge to design great shoes, I'm gonna do it?
That's pretty much it. I started it up, and there was about a year or so later, it really was just to showcase shoes. And at about the same time, there was an Australian company, a swimwear company that still exists. And I remember there was something in the news about them, who they had started an Instagram account, or were using Instagram to market their products. And of course, you know, talking about this in 2020, people go, well, duh. But back in the end of 2015, like, none of those things existed on Instagram. Yeah, there was no shopping links, and there were no, you know, you couldn't tag products or anything like that. I remember a mate who bought something off Instagram because someone had put up a post and was advertising it for sale. It was a Rafa jersey or something like that, and he works in digital marketing, and he goes, I just bought something off Instagram. I feel that this is a tipping point in my life. And little did he know, like, he was just prophesizing. Yeah, he was. And 12 months later, like, it started becoming a thing. So what started as just showcasing shoes, I was just like, well, actually, hold on. If I can build this, maybe there's the option for doing it in the future, but not in the way that we've done it now. What I had in mind was just getting some shoes at wholesale rates or something like that, sending them to finding some painters. I didn't know where I was going to find painters, but finding some painters, sending the shoes, and then doing the same thing, just selling them as one-off designs. And it's just for some scotch money, basically. Yeah. So, you know, bicycle money. And it was literally... What did we have? We had 20-something thousand followers, and it was the Christmas of 2016, and at my best mate's house, and was just, we were watching the football, Premier League, and we'd had a few, and I said, I pulled out my phone, I said, just give me a tick, I just got a response to some messages, and we've been lifelong friends, and I said, Luke, have I told you about this account that I'm running, this Instagram account? He goes, no, tell me about it. Like, we're watching a Man United game, so I wasn't very interested. And I said, mate, look, we've got 20-something thousand followers. You know, this is what I'm planning to do with it, make a bit of money on the side. And he's a chartered accountant. Yeah. And he goes, Nick, that sounds like a lot of work. Why don't we find a manufacturer and just actually make shoes, like a lot of shoes rather than just one or two? And I was like, actually, that's a really good idea. And he's just like, I'll set it up like this, and, started talking accountant talk. And I said, all right, Luke, let's do this. We'll split it down the middle, 50-50. And we'll go from there. So immediately made him a partner. He looks after all the back end stuff. He was, at the time, was the financial 2IC at a, believe it or not, a footwear company in Geelong. So he, so he knew logistics and supply chain and different manufacturers around the world that he could speak to and knew that they made more than just the shoes that they, casual shoes and stuff like that, that they would purchase. These factories do all kinds. So he had different contacts there. So he was the back end, found a manufacturer, and away we went.
That's cool.
But in that time, I should add, in that time, also discovered not an underground, but definitely a underexposed element of the cycling world, which was people painting cycling shoes. And look, I want to say this with all ego put to one side, there really wasn't any platform for this to feature these artists to one side. So I'd like to think that Velo Kicks has had a really very active and very prominent role in bringing a lot of these artists to light, like Artful Kicks and Caitlin Fielder, who's George Bennett's girlfriend.
Yeah.
And a lot of other guys who are featured across the Velo Kicks account and stories and posts now. But they definitely, like, and there's plenty of those guys who are really, really proficient painters now who saw what we were doing, got inspired and said, look, the initial artwork that I saw on your account is what inspired me to have a go. And it's just become this self-fulfilling prophecy from then, and it's just spawned this whole, because sneaker art was already occurring in the casual world, for people painting Nike Air Jordans and all that kind of stuff, but he really hadn't crossed over to cycling too much. And now there's a lot more artists now. It's really, really bled across, and of course we see pros with it. But at the time when I started, there was very little, now there's a lot, which is terrific. It presents a challenge to us, to Velo Kicks, because it's got, with everything that we do on a retail side and everything from a featuring an artist's angle, it's a lot of work. And there's a lot of stuff that goes on at the back end, especially when we're also trying to avoid being hacked. And so we're just like, going forward, whatever the platform becomes, I always want it to be one where the small artists have that capacity to be featured and can really showcase their wares to what we're fortunate to have now in terms of a rather substantial global audience. But I need to find a way to that. It also sort of isn't a massive drain on my time, which, without trying to sound too dramatic, it does. It takes a lot of hours. I don't like looking at the analytics for Instagram when it says you spent this many hours on Instagram today. I was just like, no.
Yeah, it's kind of it's very disheartening when you put two and two together, isn't it? And you're like, fuck, I've wasted X amount of hours of my life.
I definitely try and stay away from the wasted part, but like it's like there are definite times where you're just like, man, like the phone just has to go away,
like, yeah
step that. Away
I normally have on my phone, I have it set up so like 9 o'clock every night generally. Everything shuts down on it, and it's some iPhone feature where basically I have to approve things by saying that I want to view it for like a minute or 15 minutes or until the next day.
Yeah, that's so good.
Every night, I think it changes depending on the day, because it changes depending on what I know I've got on, like a week shift, like generally in the week. but it's between 9 and 10 and it just shuts off. And then also I would try and make a point, like at the weekends, generally at the weekends, I don't really reply to anything.
Yep.
Like I just,
great,
I feel like having my phone to me, like, and it's probably similar to, I think 90% of the people in the world is, you know, not only do you have, you know, your phone is for work, it's personal and social as well. Like it's kind of everything. And it frustrates the shit out of me that this thing, which is the size of a freaking very small notebook, pretty much controls our lives to some point.
Yep.
But there's a lot of positives to it. Like gets you across a country, you know, cycle across a country with it, you know. There's so many positives and definitely strengths to mobile phones, but I think you're very right. It has to be, the people need to understand there's a moderation, isn't there?
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you're right. And look, it's, I think for your own health, for the friction that it can create with others as well. I think society as a whole, it's definitely, we've benefited from them. There can be no doubt about that. But yeah, just being aware of those downsides becomes a lot more acute when you're trying to run a small business, or you're running like you know, you've got multiple irons in multiple fires across different projects, and yeah, you just got to step away.
Yeah, you have to. It's very important, definitely. So one of the things that I find really nice is, you know, we sort of covered it loosely, is you started doing your own shoes, mm-hmm. and they're like, I mean, take out the anything about the shoes, like price point wise, they're really good, first of all. Yep. Like they're not crazy prices, which for me anyway, in the UK, the prices are actually really, really good of them.
The Australian, now is the time to buy any Australian goods. Our exchange rate is horrendous.
I mean, I've legit looked like 2 or 3 times. I haven't asked you yet about like what I should get though. That's why. But like, so you did it. So you produced, you got the Blanco ones, which is just like a sort of a plain slate white. You've got a lace one and it's not a boa dial, but it's like a boa dial, isn't it?
Yeah. So it's an ATOP brand, which other people would be familiar with. Bont used to use them before they moved to Boa. And to be honest, functionality wise, they're terrific.
Mm.
I mean, I would like to do a little bit with the graphics on the dial, but you know, that's a personal thing. We've spoken to them about it and they're just like, oh, sure, look, you can do whatever you like. It's, you know, minimum order is 10,000 dials. And we're just like,
yeah, that's a lot of dials.
So, I mean, what I wouldn't give to be in that position to go, right,
let's have 20,000 in that case.
That's right. Let's pull the trigger. No problems. So I'd love to have VK or something a little bit more, because like everything with Velikicks, it's about customization. It's about individualizing it. And it's about that, just those little features, those really boutique bespoke features. And so to have something that said VK on there, or our logo or something like that, would be terrific. But that's sort of neither here nor there. People aren't buying our shoes, or at least that I'm aware of, because of the dial system. Yeah. And it's really robust, easy to replace should you need to. Funnily enough, we've spoken to Boa. And I've got a terrific relationship with them, actually. But our issue, which from coming back around to the price point, is that we don't have enough price points throughout our range to be able to get on board. Because when you come on board with Boa, what they offer is it's a complete system and across a variety of price points. And we couldn't come in with their top-level dial because, out of fairness to the other big brands, Shimano, Specialized, etc., they would be going, oh, well, hold on, how have Velikicks got that dial on a shoe that retails for, well, in Australia at least, for $200 less than ours? And that would not be an unreasonable objection for them to mount. So Boa just basically said, you need a more expensive shoe, which is certainly not a line you hear every day.
Yeah.
So we need a more expensive shoe. Yeah, to be able to get on board.
So what, and then you did, obviously you did like season 1, season 2, mm-hmm. season There is a season three. There is a season three.
Three and four. Yep.
And they were, I'm presuming they were done as like limited amount of stock, kind of once they're gone, they're gone.
Yeah. So we just saw, actually did a stock take the other day and realized that we'd sold out of season one. So thankfully the stock numbers weren't too far out and we kept the final pair for ourselves. But so season one sold out a week or so ago. Quietly. Now they're all gone. There's only about half a dozen season twos left. So we're the first, season one and two are just about done. So we got season three. Season four have been popular, like really popular, to the point where we're considering rolling them into an ongoing option because people have said, look, we want to have a black pair of shoes so that we can ride outside in the winter and not have to worry about messing up our crisp kit. So we're prepared to entertain that. But otherwise, once the seasonal offering is done, that's it.
Is there a season five coming soon?
Well, we've got, I don't know if we'll call them season five, but we're branching out. We've got two new models. Two new designs. And they're one's a SPD compatible. So one's a mountain bike shoe. And then the other one is going to be designed towards indoor cycling.
Nice. That's a
it's
definitely it's a very prominent bit of the cycling industry at the moment, as we've seen in lockdown, the amount of e-racing that's been going on, and currently it's the virtual Tour de France that's happening. What the fuck?
Yeah, but no, that's right.
Positive sides of it. There's a men's race, there's a women's race. It's easy to watch. You can watch it on YouTube. Over here, you can watch it on Eurosport. Like, it was on the TV everywhere.
Wow.
Yeah, it's on Eurosport here.
That's fantastic.
So, and loads of the e-racing has been on Eurosport and on the BBC as well at some points, which is pretty nuts. So, and you've seen Nike have done an indoor training shoe.
Mm.
Shimano has done an indoor training shoe. Like, there's definitely a demand for it. And I mean, personally, I think it's a great idea because I do a lot of indoor training, and Jesus Christ, sweating out of my feet is a real thing, and it's horrible.
Absolutely,
it's really grim.
Well, we had a fork in the road. We had the we had this design for the indoor shoe, and then we had season four, and then we hadn't let on that we were going to do an indoor shoe. So there was no one really pushing us for it. But we had quite a few people saying, when are you going to do a black shoe? And when are you going to do, and well, they actually weren't, because we changed the upper design on that one. So they weren't asking for a change in design, but they were just they wanted a black shoe. And so we had this fork in the road, and we chose to do season four, obviously without knowing everything that was going to happen with the world 6 months later. So in retrospect, if we had actually led with an indoor shoe, probably would have been very perfectly timed, really.
Definitely.
Not, of course, not to make light of what is sort of a terrible situation, and but there is a saying in business, never waste a tragedy. We'll never let a tragedy go to waste. So I'm not trying to sound like I'm profiteering off it, but a lot of people are stuck indoors because of it, and like you say, the sweating is the main one. People who are, rusting rusting out the bolts in their shoes, or the uppers are just smelling, because they're just not breathing enough. They're not drying overnight. And so what we're looking to do is to introduce, some material that'll air out, so they won't get as sweaty during activity, and they're going to air out and dry a lot quicker post activity.
It makes so much sense. What you're saying about sweaty shoes, and them smelling, just because of the nature of what you're doing in them. It's I regularly do 2 hour turbo sessions. That's quite normal for me.
Yeah.
And they fucking stink. I use one pair of shoes on the turbo because I don't want the others to stink in the same way, effectively.
Yep, absolutely. And look, and the flip side, the beneficial side is we're starting to get a lot more traction in warmer climates, Malaysia, Singapore, Thailand, places like that, Philippines. And of course, they're hot, basically all year round. I used to race for a Singaporean team, so it's always hot. And so those guys are just we love your shoes, but is there going to be one with a bit more ventilation just so we can wear it on those, you know, in the summer when it's just stifling and our feet are, you know, melting in most shoes? And Specialized obviously had just released their vented version of their S-Works 7 as well.
Mm-hmm.
Which will play to the sort of the same advantage, just airflow across the feet. So these, whilst they're we're definitely going to be, you know, sort of positioning them as an indoor shoe, they're going to have all the features. They're going to be you could ride them outside on a hot day, no problems.
Yeah, which is great. I mean, to me, it just seems like such a no-brainer to be able to have a ventilated shoe, because as you say, there isn't many options out there for it, really.
No, there's truly not. It's funny. It's, you know, you think of how far we've come with everything in cycling, you know, disc brake bikes and how clean they are. Like in Australia at the moment, SBS are doing reruns from the Tour over the last 10 years or so. And it's just incredible to look at, you know, what the bikes were like only 10 years ago. It doesn't feel that long ago. There's guys in the peloton 10 years ago who are still racing now, so it's really not that long ago. But the Shimano cabling was still not only external, but, you know, sort of, you know, the basket cage from the 7800 Durace that was just popping out the front of the levers, and no internally routed handlebars whatsoever, and loose jerseys and all that kind of stuff. So many things have improved, and shoes have improved as well. Don't get me wrong. I'm watching the shoes in the peloton thinking, gee, there was some horrible stuff back then. But from a ventilation point of view, they really haven't altered that much.
Yeah, I wonder why that is. I wonder if it is to do with partly tradition and partly maybe, as you say, the demand for cycling in hotter climates and hotter countries. You know, you look at South America and as you say, in Singapore, places where it's hot all year. Maybe it has grown a lot in the last 10 years as well. Maybe it wasn't.
True. Like Brazil, Colombia, there's a lot of, we get a lot of messages from those countries. It is mad there. They, I'm constantly using Google Translate to understand, you know, the questions that they're asking and all that kind of stuff. And, but it's like even our analytics, just without trying to put people to sleep here, just the data says that there is a lot of Velikix followers in South America. So, and yeah, like you said, it's just hot all year round and humid.
Yeah, do you know, I was looking at a podcast, going on the analytics subject, I was looking at podcast analytics last night. I get a weekly email on it. I'm trying to find it quickly. Here we go. And apparently I rank quite highly in Japan.
Good food.
Chile and Malaysia. Right. Yeah. I mean...
Cuisine-wise, all terrific countries to visit once we if we're ever allowed out.
Yeah, and also Bulgaria of all places. But yeah, apparently the podcast is listened to in those countries. That was a bit like, oh, okay.
Well, you've seen politically, Bulgaria doesn't have any coronavirus. So
yeah, I've been to Bulgaria. I went there. I actually went there quite a few years ago. It's an amazing place. But yeah, I mean, when you start to look at the different contrasting areas of where, you know, people are starting to engage with the sport, is pretty crazy. And it's good because, cycling as a sport, I mean, I was talking, I'm continually trying to figure out ways to encourage more people to ride, because one, the health benefits physically and mentally, two, it's better for our environment. And so I've been doing quite a lot of research into the costs, comparing the costs between in the UK anyway, I'm just going to find it now, comparing the different costs between if you are what it costs you to ride a bike for a year and kind of look after a bike, and then flip that with, say, train, bus, underground or car. And the figures, obviously, these are kind of overall figures, sort of rounded up from a shit ton of nerding out, trying to find as much information as I can. But the estimated cost for a car, transport cost for a car, is nearly £4,000 a year. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Underground. So, I mean, underground systems, we haven't got a lot of it in the UK, but you take London. So I base this on London Underground. If you were to get like a year pass, that's £1,300 to £1,500, depending on the zone you're in. Yeah.
Wow.
Bus. Yeah. Bus is.
That's a lot more expensive than I expected.
Yeah. The underground's not cheap. No. But it's the next. So the car's the most expensive. Then it's the underground that's the next expensive. The next one is bus, which is roughly just short of a grand a year. And then the last one is like trains, like overground trains, which like averagely you're looking at sort of. Obviously, train like year passes for trains really vary in price. From what I could see, it's anything from like a couple of £100 up to like a grand and a half.
Yeah.
But the average comes up at about 625, 650 average. And then cycling, I was trying to break down. Obviously, there's an initial cost of like buying a bike and helmet and et cetera, et cetera. But when you sort of broke it down and say like having maybe two services a year, parts that you need to replace, bike insurance, that kind of stuff. It's about £400.
And saliently, like, you get the exercise with the bike as well.
You get the exercise, you know, you're outside, it's basically, and then I was like looking at it going like, what are the like benefits of like commuting on a bike as opposed to commuting in a car? And for me, like I talked to a few people who drive for work, and they were saying that like a lot of them were saying like commuting in a car was the most stressful part of their day, and it doesn't pay them anything. They're paying for it, so you know you could look at things like you get stuck in traffic, you end up getting late. You know, it could increase like your mood, your blood pressure, anxiety, stress levels, being uncomfortable in a car because you're in a static position. And then you look on the contrast of cycling, you cycle to work, you save money because you're riding to work. You generally, your brain's more awake and you're more active. You've kind of woken up in the morning. You're not burning off fossil fuels. You know, you're building your cardiovascular system, which long term is much better for you. And also the big thing for some of the people I was talking to who have switched to cycling as opposed to driving was like, they were like, I know I'm going to get there at this time because I can get around the traffic.
Like, yeah, absolutely.
It's predictable to give a commute time. While, like, you could be stuck in traffic for like 2 hours in London quite easily. I thought it was quite interesting, like breaking it down. Like for me, I try and find as many different ways to help encourage people to cycle.
Yeah,
and I've got to the point where breaking down the cost seems to be the new option of doing it.
To that end, and I mean, it's. We're preaching to the converted here for people who are listening to this podcast. But I had a client about a year or so ago. He got diagnosed with diabetes and went on to medication. Now it was only the lowest level of medication, but he was still having to take a tablet a day. Short range truck driver. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like those commuter band kind of things.
Short range truck driver. That in Australia is still like longer than the UK, no?
Yeah, that's right. So he was only traveling half the distance of Victoria each day. That's right. You know. But it meant like he wasn't in the truck overnight. So he'd go to the depot in the morning and then finish at the depot at night. And he'd seen me a couple of times previously. So he knew I don't clients don't walk through the door and I go, hi, I'm Nick, I'm a cyclist. But that sort of it comes out one way or another half the time. And so, then he came in with this diagnosis and he said, look, Nick, he goes, I know I've given you a hard time about riding bikes before. Don't laugh, but I think I'm going to start riding to work. And I was just like, good, perfect. Like, all right, let's do this. And he didn't live that far. It was about 10K, a bit over 10K from home to work. Started riding to work. 6 months later, blood pressure, diabetes tablet gone, blood pressure meds halved. He'd lost 6 kgs, so like, but beautifully, like losing about a kilogram a month. New man, and that's it. And he didn't have to. So he didn't, and I didn't have to get. And the doctor didn't have to tell him. Like he didn't have his weekends were his own because he'd exercised going to and from work during the week, so it didn't cut into any family time with him. He still had a couple of kids at home. It was like it just ticked every box he could have been looking for, you know, health-wise, life-wise, everything. And he, like, he still gave, you know, still had a laugh at me for Lycra, as he absolutely should. Like, you know, it's amazing that we get away with getting around in Lycra. But, it's like you say, like the benefits. And then, of course, then there's all the other benefits for the globe, which are fantastic. But just from a health point of view, and it's worrying because I would have every second client who, if there's a new client walking through the door, if they're over about the age of 35 or not, I'm going to assume that there's a very high chance that they're coming in because they've just been diagnosed with diabetes or they're on the borderline of it and they need to find pathways to help avoid it. And so it's such a problem.
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? I mean, it's getting better. Like there's definitely, there's growth in the UK anyway, there's massive growth in cycling, very clearly. We will get there eventually.
Do you still get the tax write-off for those the cycle scheme?
Yeah, the cycle scheme still exists, and then
that's brilliant.
There's a campaign that started up very recently, which actually started by a friend of mine called Adam Tranter, which is called Bike is Best. Mm. And the whole idea of that is to encourage people, like loads of brands have got behind it in the UK. It's pretty nuts how many kind of like big brands have got behind it. So you look at the partners on it. You've got Cannondale, Bicmo, Pedalsure. They're like bike insurance guys.
Yep.
Sigma Sports, which is like one of the largest independent bike shops. Hot Chili, who organise like cycle tours. Muck Off, Wahoo, Hunt Wheels, Canyon, Specialized.
That's fantastic.
Chain Reaction. The list is huge. Brompton, Yellow Jersey, which is another insurance company. Lacole. Beryl, who make lights, British Cycling, Wiggle, Strava, Schwalbe Tires, Hiplock, Komoot, Cycle Scheme. Like, I could go on. It's a massive list. And the idea of it is all these partners have joined together. And it's like one of the first times this has happened in the UK in like a very, very long time. The idea is everyone's joining together. Everyone's put a bit of money towards it to help promote cycling in a positive outlay as much as possible, and that and part of that has been like TV adverts, billboard adverts, allowing people, providing education on how to cycle, like cycle safety, cycle security, where you can get your bike fixed, all that kind of stuff. It's about increasing education, exposure, and awareness, and it's great. It's really, really great. And it's not just about road bikes, it's hand bikes, it's, you know, everything under the heading of cycling, which is really good. So there's a lot of like support for that side of it. And in lockdown, I read that they were saying that there was I think it was 1.3 million bikes were sold in the strict lockdown period in the UK when we were allowed to exercise outside once a day.
Oh, I've got no doubt. It's same thing here. One of the stores that stocks VeloKicks, I had a chat to them and I said, how are you guys going sales-wise? And they said, look, this is better than any of the last five Christmases that we've had.
Yeah. Which, it's great that there is a bit of a positive coming out of it, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Not everyone's going to carry on with the bikes afterwards. But there's so many people on them that it's going to, you know, the bike numbers, just they just can't help but swell. I mean, our bike path, they were taking traffic measurements on the bike paths around Melbourne, and the minimum increase on them was 200%. Traffic was up. Like the rest of them up 250-300% traffic wise. It's absolutely staggering in a terrific way.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. That's amazing. The bike paths and everything in Melbourne are really good as well. Much better. The infrastructure you've got in place is much better than we have currently in the UK, definitely.
They're just not mapped really well. I mean, well, you saw them when we were coming back from Ballarat. They're not especially well. There's no website to go to. Like, because, you know, when I moved to Melbourne a couple of years ago, I got here and I'd have mates going, oh, look, just jump on this bike path and da da da. And I was like, unless somebody's pointed them out to you, it's Google Maps, you can kind of work it out from Google Maps and now Wahoo with their mapping. But otherwise, unless you know them, it can be a bit daunting on even just how to find, like, to get onto the trail. That trail spat out like right near my house. And I'm just like, oh, okay. This is where it exits. Like, we all learned on that afternoon on the way to the pub that that was where the bike path finished. We would. I think Melbourne would definitely benefit from that being a little bit better signposted. But that being said, the infrastructure is there, which is terrific.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm gonna do my dreaded last question to you, my friend. Which I really enjoy these. I really, really enjoy these. Five tips or hacks.
Now, I mean, you were good. You gave me a little bit of advanced warning on this one. So, I mean, I think, look, the first tip would be there's a guy, Jordan Sayat, on Instagram. I don't know if you follow him. He's a fitness guru guy, but he's not like the bro science kind of thing. He's very, very pragmatic, and I like a line that he uses quite regularly when it comes to diet, but it can be applied for most things in life. If you fail at something, whether it's, you know, you smash a packet of Tim Tams or you don't get to a workout or you don't get through a workout or something like that, that isn't failure. Giving up is the failure. Don't let little setbacks, you know, sort of dominate your thinking, and don't let, you know, the lesson is don't overblow something, and don't write it off as a failure, because you absolutely can recover from it. Failure is giving up. Setbacks are part of the journey.
Exactly.
If I've learned anything from racing, from velo kicks, it's that there will be setbacks, and you either learn from them, or, you know, you either learn from them. Like, there's no, you don't lose. I either learn or I win. Is a line that sort of entered my universe only a few months ago, and I really like it. You either learn or you win. There's no losing.
One that hit me recently that I was reading I listen to a lot of audiobooks, and the quote was, failure isn't the opposite of success, it's part of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That's fantastic. So there you go. So that's tip number one. Nice. Tip number two. I'm going to push back, and, you know, I'll have some of the sort of non-business ones after this, but the whole, you know, that saying, fake it till you make it.
Yeah.
I'm not a big fan of that, because you can inadvertently create a noose for your own noose for your neck. So there's many, many people who contact VeloKit thinking that it's my full-time job, and if they don't get a response immediately, they're a bit upset or something like that. And I'm just like, this is probably because I've created the perception that VeloKit is a full-time gig, and that we've got a host of marketing experts and copywriters and all that kind of stuff, and we've got a factory and a warehouse and et cetera, et cetera. The reality is it's two guys with the stock split between two garages, and my business partner's got two kids and a wife that he likes belly kicks, but he loves them more, rightly so.
Yeah.
And so we're kind of doing this, you know, as a side hustle. Not to say that we don't love it, not to say we wouldn't love it to be our full-time job, but if you really employ this fake it until you make it, you do create that possibility for people to be a little bit disappointed when expectation doesn't meet reality and you're a little bit smaller and a little bit more sort of underground than they are expecting. So I would just be wary of that one, because that was the mindset that I had when I started the business, was to sort of appear to be this professionally polished run organization, and you never want to be giving excuses to people. It's like, oh, you know, your shoes haven't gone out for the last, weren't posted from 3 or 4 days ago because I've been laid out with work and, you know, my business partner hasn't seen his family, let alone the inside of the garage to post the kicks all week. And it can be a little bit hard to explain that to some people. Most people are very understanding.
Yeah, I think but it's just a case of realizing it, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Now, tip number three. I don't consume. I'm not vegetarian, but I don't consume a whole lot of meat. So, you know, I'm quite keen on finding ways to have what would be a traditional sort of traditional meat meal, but turn it into a veggie option. Mm-hmm. And I love satay chicken, right?
Yeah.
So what I've discovered is that if you take, instead of the chicken, if you take a can of butter beans and you take a can of lentils and you replace the chicken, you have those and just use your typical satay sauce recipe from there. The butter beans, the lentils sort of bulk it out a little bit, but the butter beans, once they're cooked down, have a texture not too dissimilar to slow-cooked chicken. You get through the meal, and I've had people who have been like, well, at least initially didn't even know what they were being dished up, and just like, this is terrific. That's, you know, and they had no idea about it. And others who were actually vegetarians who were a bit skeptical, and by the end of it, they were just like, what's the recipe? And I'm just like, well, you know, there's no science to it. But yeah, I really enjoy finding meat dishes and creating a vegetarian replacement for them.
Nice.
Same with like veggio chili con carne as well. Four jars of, replace the mince with, sort of a mixture of bean mix, mash it all up, and that'll replace the mince beautifully. And then you use your normal con carne recipe and it cooks up just like chili con carne.
Loving it.
Oh, man. They're such a winner.
I'm so, like, I'm all about that. Like, fine. Yep. And, like, I quite often do barbecues for friends and stuff, and it's a completely vegetarian barbecue. And do, like, buy things that look, or otherwise produce things that could be perceived as being meat orientated, or things that, like in the UK, there's this brand called Beyond who make completely vegan burgers, but I literally could not tell the difference. Like, to the point that it slightly sickened me. Because part of the reason why I'm vegetarian, one, my grandparents ran an animal charity, so never sat right with me. Two, part of it is like the fact I feel like we're over farming. But a big part for me is also I just don't really like the taste of it. So one of these Beyond Meat burgers, I had it and I was like, that's a bit meaty for me.
Yes, hitting a little bit too close to home.
Yeah. So I think that's great. That's awesome. Nice.
Okay. Yeah.
We've got two more.
Right. I'm not sure if you've covered this in other episodes, but waxing chains. I know it sounds like for people who aren't like racers and stuff like that, and they look at it and they go, oh, gee, there's a bit of rigmarole to that, yada, yada. Seriously, wax your chain. It is nowhere near as daunting as it might seem.
Yeah.
Once you get through those initial steps, and it makes cleaning the bike after, once that's done, man, it makes cleaning your bike so much easier. You just whip the chain off. There's guys in the bunch now who would ask me, like, why is your drivetrain always so clean? And I'm just like, I'll look down and, you know, that chain actually might be ready to be swapped off for a new waxed one. And I'd be looking at it and just going, oh, no, it's not really. Like, I could scrub, because all you do is scrub the cassette, but it just keeps it so clean. The friction stuff and the lower friction and rolling resistance, that stuff, like, that's a bonus. Seriously, it's not having all that degreaser and shit around your bike and that degreaser going into your jockey wheels and into your bottom bracket. You avoid all that rubbish. You're not washing degreaser down the drain as well, which I also like. You just take the chain off, get a soft brush, brush the bits of wax away, and then like washing your bike is so much, it's so quick, it's just a bit of soapy water. Bam.
I am so with you on this, because as you say, part of it is, I mean, the friction side of it, that's just, as you say, it's a bonus, but it's so clean. It's so clean and so easy to maintain. And I used wax chains for time trialing, where that friction thing is obviously useful for general riding around on the road, for racing, and also for like off-road. Like, it just keeps it clean. You don't worry about shit sticking to your chain.
Yeah, well, that too, exactly. It just picks up so much less road grease. It's better in the wet as well. Like, so if it gets wet and greasy, take your chain off when you get home, pop it in a little pot of, and put some boiling water over it. That cleans off the shitty, dirty wax. Rewax it, bam. There's your bike clean, halfway done. Yeah. It is, yeah. And yeah, that's right. And the friction stuff. And here's the other thing. Like, friction-wise, my last, I rotate two chains. I got nearly 30,000 kilometers out of two chains, and the cassette is still absolutely fine.
That says it all.
30,000 kilometers, two chains. That is, man. So, like, in terms of, like, it's cost savings are incredible. And you can reuse the quick links. Not forever, but, a bit longer than what the manufacturers recommend.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I'm with you. You don't need to persuade me anymore.
Yeah, right.
There's a lot of people that maybe don't quite realize it yet. And it's getting there. It's definitely getting there slowly. I think people are starting to come around a bit more and more.
I've got more mates this year. I've definitely got more mates who are asking me, who initially scoffed at me and all that kind of, with that sort of stuff. And they're just like, and the other question is like, what happens when you go away? I was just like, just pack another chain in a snap lock bag, and halfway through whatever training camp or whatever, you get, 400 or 500 Ks out of a chain. Like, if you're doing more than 1,000 Ks at a training camp, like, just take the wax pot.
Yeah,
but otherwise, just take a second chain. Bam. Easy.
Completely with me. Yeah.
Right.
One more.
Now, this is especially for me and my circulation issues. But if you do get really cold toes, if you get, heaven forbid, chilblains like I do, you can use, there's a couple of things you can use on your toes in addition to those. I never had much luck with those packets that you would sort of shake, or you'd snap them and they would warm up, and you could, put them in your shoe covers. Like, they're okay. But vapor rub on the tips of your toes will help with a really sort of gentle, it'll stimulate the superficial blood flow. Mm-hmm. And if you're finding that that's not hardcore enough, you can do what I do and use a little bit of embrocation on the tips of your toes and just around the forefoot before putting, your winter woolen socks on and your shoe covers on. If you're heading out for a decent length of ride, because if it's only a short ride of, say, an hour and a half or maybe 2 hours, when you get home, that embro on your toes is the same as, like, the embro on your legs, and you step into the shower and, yeah, there's a lot of blood flow there, and it starts to feel like it's burning. But embro on the toes and on the tips of your fingers, just a very, very small amount in the winter, is an absolute godsend to avoid chilblains and to keep things nice and toasty.
Nice. That is a good. That's a really good tip, actually, that one.
Yeah. Trust me, man. Like, in November, December, yeah, give it a go. Especially because, like, it's good with ETAP. ETAP's you don't need a lot of dexterity to operate it. But, DI2, if you've got sort of big hands and you can't feel your hands and you're trying to hit the levers and stuff like that, or if you've still got mechanical, your hands are going cold and they're struggling to really clench and to contract, that's problematic.
Yeah. I know I suffer with it with mechanical gearings. I always find my joints stiffen up in the winter. So yeah, I know that feeling. Like, DI2, I don't find it. It's much more easier, definitely. And then also the addition of disc brakes makes it a shit ton easier as well, because you just
stop.
But yeah, like, great solid tip selection.
Oh yeah, and also ensure that you put your chamois cream on before the embro. Just in case anyone makes that mistake, has been done before. So that's not a region that normally needs warming.
Wow. On that note,
yeah, that's right. A bonus tip. Bonus tip for anyone else.
Oh man, thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Get to chill out for the rest of the evening. I've got to go to work.
Yeah, right. Good luck with that one.
Yeah. Cheers, dude.
Okay. Thanks, mate.